Good day, and welcome again to From Out of the City. My name is William Duvall, and this is the week of April 22nd, 2006. If you're listening to this on the afternoon of April 22nd, 2006, I'm currently doing a signing and a reading at a Barnes & Noble in Morgantown, West Virginia. If you're listening to this before that occasion, get in your car and head there if you're close enough. And if afterwards, check my blog for updates on how it went. Hope you've had a great week. Hope you're enjoying National Poetry Month. Yes, I know the fireworks shows and the parades get a little heavy, but it's just something you have to deal with, considering how important poetry is in the lives of Americans nowadays. Yes, that was not so thinly veiled sarcasm. Nevertheless, I digress. A couple things. Next week, the show for the 29th of April will be my long-promised tribute to Gertrude Stein. Please don't miss it. I think you'll find it illuminating, if nothing else. I believe Ms. Stein is one of the more underrated American poets, and judging from the large number of volumes of hers one cannot find in your local public library and bookstores, somebody needs to get a severe kick in the pants. And I'm just the guy to do it. Got word just a little bit ago that Daniel S. McTaggart is in the final stages of releasing his book. He got the proof copy today. And tomorrow I'm going to be sitting down with him, which is Thursday, the 20th. This is actually being recorded on the 19th, and help him put final touches on that. So that's very exciting for him. Congratulations, Dan. And now for a little bit of news that I've been promising for some time. A few months ago, I announced that I'd be taking my books From an Unexpected Quarter and Love Gods of a Forgotten Religion out of circulation, which I did. I have been persuaded by both fellow writers and the mercantile instinct, shall we say, to leave them back in production. So they are being restored to production, and they are again available through Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and through your local bookstores. Plus, whenever you encounter me on tour, I'll probably be toting around a box of them. So don't hesitate to buy one. They're lovely books with some lovely material inside and very nice covers. I had a very beautiful and inspiring model for those covers, and I know she appreciates it every time someone looks at it and goes, wow. Now, this changes some other plans. My previously announced intention was this year to release Theocracide in the early summer, to be followed by 101 Great Erotic Poems late summer or early fall, and then another book around Christmas. This plan changes. Here's what's going to happen now. This summer, my volume from last year, The Morgantown Suite Poems, will go to full distribution, which means it will be available through bookstores, both online and in the real world. The price of it will go up slightly to feed the middleman. One of the ways I'd kept the price so low, in order to honor Arts Monongahela, the group that all of the proceeds from that book go to, was to leave out the middleman, which of course limited the number of stores and outlets willing to carry the book. So the price of the book will go up, probably into the $15 to $16 range, but more on that later. I am still going forward with 101 Great Erotic Poems. And then finally, December 14th, 2006, I will be releasing my book, Ronan in the Temple of Aphrodite. Mark that on your calendars. I think you're going to find it an extraordinary book and an extraordinary event, because I'm going to make of this every bit the event, if not more so, that the release of the complete Panther Cycles was. And I hope you enjoy it immensely. We're moving forward. We're moving forward aggressively. And I'm grateful to all of you who have been so supportive over the last few years in terms of my writing and in terms of my production of my books. I have no intention of stopping at any time short of the grave. And who knows what machinations I may leave in terms of instructions to be followed out after I pass.
Hold the bridge. while the world goes mad and the rattles scrabble like one-eyed dogs for the last bones, baying and praying to perversions of the Almighty, killing in the name of peace, cursing in the name of redemption. Hold the bridge with the poets and the minstrels and the ronin, who would rather die an honorable death than live a lie forced upon them by misguided honor. Lovers who love and dreamers who dream until the steam rises from their pyres at dawn. Hold the bridge just long enough to let those of courage have the second water, but fire nonetheless. Burn and hack away the cords that forward hope and fall away to seal the base cowards of snide pride and fell principles. Hold the bridge. It is not enough to avoid evil. You must also resist it with every breath in mortal foam and shadow cast into the coming days to inspire those who seek legends and mythologies and the mystery of history where there are those who dare to, who care to. Hold the bridge.
That's a new piece of mine called Hold the Bridge. I recently posted to Author's Den and on my blog at cityoflegends.blogspot.com. You can also reach that from the links on my website, which is www.cityoflegends.com. I enjoyed that piece a great deal. It came to me when I was contemplating a little bit of political writing I was reading, and it brought me back to the notion of Horatius at the bridge, one of my favorite stories of yore. And I honestly feel that creative artists, poets, musicians, painters, sculptors need to hold the bridge in culture. National Poetry Month should be a time of rededication to the art, the religion of poetry, because poetry has a founding role in almost every major valid world religion. Poetry originally came to be as a means of structuring language to make an oral tradition easier to pass on from generation to generation to generation. And as the scriptures of almost every world religion began as an oral tradition, even the earliest books of the Old Testament of the Holy Bible, without the poets, without the poetry, there would not be religions in the form that we know them today. Oh yes, there would still be tax break clubs for individuals who want to take advantage of the tax breaks available to anybody who decides to call their social club or their pet form of pop psych a religion. But the true, legitimate religions of the world would not exist. And histories, not just theologies, but histories of many cultures would have been lost forever. The inspirations on which we build the fundamental foundations of our culture would have been washed away forever in the rivers of time. So next time somebody says, "What's the big deal about poetry?" you don't even have to answer them, because you already know the answer. The mere fact that there is a modern culture in which there is language, in which there are rites, in which there is literature, all lay their very existence at the altar of the religion of the Church of Poetry. Don't forget that. There is no wine so bitter as that of loving in futility. A mirror that does not reflect, a wall that does not protect a given heart from the folly of ill-considered sacrifice. So let it be with Caesar. The vague smile of faded solemnity, the wings of Icarus melted and molted. Abject objects in the museum of muses, unamused by the poet's artifice.
The oil slick on the Avalon Sea grows darker and thicker, so that the setting sun is reflected in colors courting crimson. To smile when the bile rises regent in the throat and veins is a trick for the fakir, with his bowls inverted, quicker to beg the blessings than to build on solid ground when sun and sky alike strike sullen with the hypocrisy of love and pain.
I was going through some poems that I had placed in Author's Den. If you've never been to Author's Den before, it's www.authorsden.com. Thousands of writers post there, some good, some great, some just starting out. But it's a great place to see some raw material, and I'm one of the longest-standing writers associated with that site. And I've been posting there for years, and when I write something, quite often I'll go there and put it, just to kind of get it out there into the world. And that piece I just read you is a piece called Elysium's Illusions, Soulquake, April 9th, 2004. It was written in one of those moments where I achieved an epiphany. I had just realized what was going on in my second marriage and how far it was already over the cliff. And it was a very sad moment for me. And this was sort of my poem of mourning. Although, if you take a look at the Author's Den posting of it, in the comments field I put, "Note to the Fates, bite me." I have found with age I've become a lot more defiant towards the fates than I might have been at one time in my life, and that's fine. The fates need to learn to get the heck out of my way once in a while. Earlier this week, a friend asked me how I pick the pieces that I do at a public reading, and I just wanted to give my opinions on that topic to those of you out there who are writing poetry and would like to share it sometime in a public forum. There are several different schools of thought. The simplest is, if you've only written a few poems, just read all your poems. That keeps things very simple. In my case, though, somebody once calculated if I tried to read all my poems at one sitting, giving 1 minute per poem, it would take something like, oh God, what was it? 720, something like 13 days if I didn't sleep or eat or go to the bathroom. I don't know about you, but I like doing those things once in a while, at least once every couple days. So that could be a problem. But for those of you who have somewhere between 2 and 13,000 poems in your collection, it's really quite simple. First, you need to evaluate what you want to read, because reading something that you want to read is going to be a whole lot easier than reading something you don't want to read. Second of all, read it out loud when you're by yourself. Listen for your voice. Listen to hear if the poem is even something you can read aloud. Some poems, not because of their content, but because of their structure, are almost impossible to present aloud. I have a couple pieces that, my Lord, I must be nuts anytime I step up to a microphone with them. Oh, and that's another thing. I hate microphones. And somebody put it out there that it's because they're not organic enough. That's total crap. I'm the romantic poet of the internet. I like technology. I just never know how to deal with them. I tend to move a lot when I present. And it's really tough to make sure I keep equidistance from the microphone. Or as one musician friend of mine said, man, you suck at the mic. Thanks, Dave. I really appreciated that comment. It made me feel very good about it. But anyway, it's up to you whether you want to work with a microphone or not. And sometimes that's going to be completely enforced upon you by the venue. If they don't have a microphone, it's not an issue. If you need the amplification to be heard, it's not an issue. Anything in between, go with your own judgment. It's part of the thing about art. You have a lot of control. You have the poet's license to do things the way you want to do them. Nothing wrong with that. Go for it. Now, back to selecting your poetry. There are two schools of thought, and I call them the Sinatra versus the Elton John school. Supposedly, Sinatra, when he used to tour with the Rat Pack and he would do his set of songs, always liked to open with three songs that everybody knew. Ideally songs that not only everybody knew, that were pretty much showstoppers, so that after that he could do new material or even, you know, not do his best, and people would still remember those three songs. And they would accept whatever he gave beyond that. The Elton John school is a little different. Elton John used to talk about how he liked to, in concert, start slow, build big, and finish with a climax, and he compared it to making love. I don't know about you, but I kind of like everything between the goalposts and making love, but, you know, to his own. I understand the whole concept of building to a climax. I just don't smoke, so after doing a reading, I don't want to have to, you know, lay on the floor and smoke a cigarette. But it's up to you how you do it. How do I do it? Generally, I just start picking out pieces at random, reading through them and going, eh, feels right, eh, feels wrong. Build it into stacks. I put together what's called a read book often. And often, in many cases, I'll take just the read book with me, which is just individual broadsides of the poems I'm planning to read. And as I read them, I have something I can give to members of the audience. I can sign them, or if they're incredibly cute, write my phone number and my room number on the back. But that's another story altogether. I have gone to venues prepared to read half an hour and then be told, we're only going to give you 10 minutes. I went to one venue taking about a half hour's worth of material, and after an hour, when I finally ended, because there were some requests from the audience, the venue said, you're not going to go till 11, which would have been 3 hours. I don't know about you, but a three-hour reading would kill my throat. And I can talk with the best of them, don't get me wrong, but three straight hours presenting, that would be just a little rough for me. I could do it. I've often talked about plans of doing a show called Night of 1,000 Poems, where I just read through 1,000 poems. Or even, there was one suggestion once that I do a reading where I do the complete Panther Cycles, cover to cover. That would take several hours, although it might be an interesting reading to do sometime, just for the emotional resonance that I would get from that. So anyway, those are some of my thoughts on how to select poems to read. In the end, pick what's comfortable for you. Just as I wouldn't pretend to tell you what you should write, I'm not going to tell you what you should read. You should go with what's comfortable for you and the way you present material. You should know your material before you get up there. And it's not a bad idea to have a couple pieces memorized, just in case you need to go to them. I remember one read during the Southern Poets reading tour. My read book just wasn't working for me. And I got up with my shades on, and I proceeded to do three or four poems that I had memorized. And these were poems that are very heavy emotionally for me. And it really wrenched me. And in fact, you'll find in one of the Leopard Cycles a poem called Breathe, which is about that very incident, which occurred at the Fairhope Arts Center in Fairhope, Alabama, back in the summer of 97, I believe it was. Wow, 9 years ago. Where do the years go? But anyway, National Poetry Month, we're more than halfway through it. Please, if you haven't already availed yourself of some of the poetry resources in your town, in your city, in your neighborhood, do so. If there's an open mic reading, even if you don't write poetry, take something in the public domain. Take a classic poem from Edgar Allan Poe or Percy Bysshe Shelley or George Gordon, Lord Byron, or Lewis Carroll even. Take it down there and read it. Be part of this. Be part of the rich cultural heritage. Not just American culture, but all cultures. Poetry exists in every language and every culture of the world, and it's very, very important to our histories, to our philosophies, to our theologies. Anyway, I've bent your ear enough for this week. Please join us next week when we're going to be looking at the works of Gertrude Stein. Again, this is William F. DeVault, the romantic poet of the internet, and you've been listening to From Out of the City.